Okay, everyone, welcome to Open Sources Guelph. You're on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
Scotty Hertz of the CFRU News Team. Adam, I guess you had a bit of a retro news day today. Did you, like, go buy a paper or something? Adam's internet was out for 24 hours.
Where would I buy a paper?
Got the printing press out of the basement there, ran off a little mimeographed sheets of Guelph Politico. It's purple, but don't smell it.
No, what I did is I got like my old copies of The Ontarian out, and I read through them like it's 2002.
Yeah, good times. And for the classified ad.
you guys hear about this thing called the War on Terror? Yeah, no.
Or this new thing called Facebook that's going to bury us. Yeah.
It's called The Facebook, yeah.
The no. Facebook.
Yeah, not a great internet day, unfortunately. No. Open Source is the CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show, and you can find us here every Thursday at 5 p.m. as we talk about the latest news items from Guelph, Ontario, Canada, and around the world. And we sometimes interview local newsmakers and politicians. This week, though, we're just doing the news, including Super Tuesday. It was pretty super if you are Joe Biden or Donald Trump. It was significantly less super if you're Nikki Haley or someone that likes representative democracy. But we're going to get into that. Then, Canada. We now have a plan to implement universal pharmacare, but do the Liberals have what it takes to see it through? And finally, Friday is International Women's Day, and we're going to talk about the economic case for equity. Yes, you heard that right. Scotty's ears are bleeding as we speak. But first, Brian Mulroney, 18th Prime Minister of Canada, passed away about this time last week, or it was announced about this time last week. One of Canada's most divisive prime ministers, it said on the headline from the Globe and Mail tweet that a lot of people took umbrage with. I was kind of surprised by that, because divisive seems like the right word for Brian Mulroney, especially if you like grew up in the 80s, early 90s, and sort of remember what it was like, especially near the end of his premiership. But I mean, it's also a pretty good descriptor of the, I think, of how that man led. You know, he did stand against apartheid, which was good. He did stand to fight environmental issues like acid rain and the hole in the ozone layer caused by CFCs. On the other hand, he had a number of neoliberal policies that sucked, and we are sort of continually being victimized by a lot of those decisions made in the 80s. He tried to patch Quebec into the Constitution and failed at that twice. But I think, you know, a couple of things I've read about Brian Mulroney in the last week, and we'll get to the other in a sec, but I think one of the big ones for me is that, you know, regardless of what happened, he was a prime minister who took big swings. And I'm thinking a lot about Justin Trudeau, who, you know, you seem to be able to box in and make him like so petrified to make him even a simple motion that he won't. You know, we're going to talk about pharmacare in a minute, but it is weird now to have a politician who's like, yeah, I'll stake some political capital on that. Sure. I'll put it all on red, or I'll put it all on black, whatever that is. And, you know, regardless of how you feel about the man, and I'm sure Scotty has some considerable feelings about Brian Mulroney. He was a gambler. And I think we don't get that enough in politics anymore.
No, there is a fear for sure to take a chance on anything, let's say.
Yeah.
Everything's measured now and is canned and needs to be contained and controlled.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a different era. I mean, Mulroney got the boots, what, it's 30 years ago now, right?
Yeah.
But you mentioned neoliberalism there. And the best description I heard of all the talk on the weekend was that he was Canada's first neoliberal prime minister. And that's very true, because the man was corporate. Right. He was a corporatist, and that's his claim to fame.
Yeah.
The other aspect, which is, well, not painful to listen to, but everybody who talks like, well, his father was an electrician. His father was a luxury. To imply that Mulroney represented this working class background, which he did have, but then he immediately, not immediately, but he threw it away. Like, Mulroney was born into that time. He was essentially a boomer, right?
Yeah. Where
opportunity knocked, and he took those opportunities and became a lawyer and a corporate lawyer, and then in charge of, was it the Iron Ore Company of Canada? So, of course, he was a corporate person.
Yeah.
That's his origin story, whether his father was an electrician or not. The thing is, being that person, and he ended his life on a whole ton of boards of directors, those boards of directors are the ones that wouldn't hesitate to fire Brian Mulroney's father from the company that they've taken over and run into the ground because it's an equity firm, whatever. All true, right?
Yeah, no. Like, you can fire the guy who's like 30 years on the job and then get like a contract person and like outsource to a one of those temp agencies for sure.
Exactly. And this gets lost in the wash because, oh, you're not supposed to speak ill of the dead or whatever. It's like, if they've earned it, you need to point these things out, right?
Yeah.
So, and the number one board that he was on, who are the absolute worst worldwide, Blackstone. He was on the board of Blackstone. Now, folks remember who listen to the show regularly. It was a movie I talked about at Christmas called Push, about the special rapporteur for housing.
Yep.
Blackstone figured very prominently in that because they were the worst for rent evictions, kicking people out, buying public housing, and capitalizing on that. And Brian Mulroney was on the board of that. So that's, from beginning to end, it was all about business. Now, if you love business, if you love corporatists, if you love that, then you would have loved Brian Mulroney. But the opposite of that is that, I mean, considering the clobbering that he took on the way out the door and put in Kim Campbell as a sacrifice, something that looks good, it's like, oh, she'll be the first female prime minister and the last so far, right?
Mm-hmm.
Knowing that you're going to get killed, that's pretty shrewd politics there as well, right?
Yeah, remember, there used to be a progressive conservative federal party, and it was more or less torn apart. Some of them went to separatism, Bloc Québécois. Some of them went to the Reform Party. And, there weren't enough left sort of in the proverbial center to hold it up. There were, for a solid decade, you had like two guys, Jean Charest and, somebody else who was like the holding the flag of what was left of the PCs in the House. And yeah, absolutely. Like, and that's the cost of being a gambler. At some point, the House always wins. And the House did win at one point. Fortunately for Brian Mulroney, it was kind of after he was already out the door. But that's because, like, he had made himself kind of so, like, from free trade, GST. I mean, he was, Reagan and Thatcher in some quarters, granted, are kind of more well thought of because they were able to bail before the check came due. Mulroney wasn't that lucky. He was there when the check came due. I have like a political cartoon in my files here somewhere that's like him and the finance minister at the time, and they're like in a dark tunnel and they see a light, and one of them says, hey, look, there's a light at the end of the tunnel. We're almost out of this recession. And Brian Mulroney says, run, you fool. It's a Chamber of Commerce lynch mob. So that was like that was in the Toronto Star. That was, that wasn't, a leftist paper by any stretch of the imagination. He had really worn out his welcome. The flip side of this, too, and this, speaking of political cartoons, I think it was a dad or... I think it was, but it was Pierre Poilievre walking past a Brian Mulroney statue, and Poilievre is muttering under his breath about Mulroney being like a woke jerk. And I mean, but there's something very, very true about that right now. Like, Brian Mulroney, for all the reasons you outline, is a God the Father conservative, but Pierre Poilievre, he's a completely different brand of conservative. It's sort of weird reading all these commentaries about how Mulroney was offering good advice to Justin Trudeau and dealing with Donald Trump and American populism. Would Brian Mulroney had been an advisor to Pierre Poilievre? And Poilievre has said, like, oh yeah, no, he was a good mentor. And I'm like, was he? Was he a mentor to you? Like, what do you guys have in common? I'm not 100% sure, but it does really seem like Walt Mulrooney's passing, you know, really is kind of an end of the era now.
Well, Mulroney is directly responsible for the rise of Pierre Poilievre.
Indirectly, yeah.
Kind of indirectly, but he's essentially, you know, the angry bastard son of the conservatism of 30 years ago. Because as you mentioned there about the split, Mulroney's friend Lucien Bouchard leaves the conservatives and forms the Bloc Québécois. And angry Preston Manning forms the Reform Party. This is two strains of conservatism, although the Bloc went more left, split off at that time because everybody was pissed off with Brian Mulroney. Mm-hmm. And where did Poilievre get his start? It was with the Reform Party. It wasn't with the conservatives at all. He was on the reform side of the equation. And then Mulroney and a bunch of them 20 years ago now was like, it would be a really good idea if we got back together. And within that mix, what you get spit out from that is Pierre Poilievre. And of course, he can't say anything bad about him because he's family.
Mm.
Essentially part of that big blue tent family. But going back to corporate again, when the conservatives had their meeting for their national council,
mm-hmm.
that national council of conservatives is littered with corporate lobbyists and business people. It's somewhere in the range of 50%. Every person on that council has a stake in business or is a lobbyist.
Mm-hmm.
And it's shameless now, whereas there was some shame back in Mulroney's day.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, there's a reason why the popular biography of Mulroney back in the day was called On the Take. Because that is exactly what happened. He hasn't been the prime minister for 30 years, but he teed up his future with all that stuff I mentioned before. Corporate influence, corporate lobbyists, friends with Trump. Well, I don't know if they were direct friends, but there's a sphere of influence there. And, you know, in some ways, Trudeau Jr. is a descendant of all of that as well, because, you know, the way things are lined up now is very similar to what happened when Mulroney was elected. You've got a liberal government well past its due. It was Pierre Trudeau. Now it's Justin Trudeau.
Yeah.
All the polls are saying it's going to be a drubbing. It might not be as high as the Mulroney drubbing of the Trudeau liberals back in the day, but it's going to be really high. It's going to be in the 200s if the polling is anything to go by. So this is it's kind of like a rerun.
Mm.
All we need is a recession. And it will be the early 90s again. And I hated the early 90s.
Mm.
I came of age in the early 90s. And it was like, it was the first time in my life that I needed, it was unemployment insurance then. And within that range, it became employment insurance. Something, if we want to talk about the litany of Mulroney sell-offs, right?
Mm-hmm.
That was when his government decided that they weren't going to pay into formerly unemployment, then employment insurance anymore. It's just the responsibility of workers and employers. And then, of course, Harper in the future, like, pretty much robbed that fund. Right. So it's like he is the godfather of all everything that we're seeing now. Right. The mm-hmm. big daddy
mm-hmm.
checks out before he can see Poilievre's. I didn't want to say it. Don't make me say it. Don't make me say it, Adam.
No, but it's true. There's a lot kind of, you know, history rhymes kind of situations. You don't get Mike Harris without Brian Mulroney too. Like the Ontario Conservatives, one another, which is why it was interesting having Doug Ford make a statement like, "Oh, he's a mentor to me. He was such a great guy," and I'm like, I dare Doug Ford to pick Brian Mulroney out of a lineup, but I don't think he knows. But it just like there was a price that was paid in the year since, you know, the increased debt and deficits that Mulroney racked up. I mean, that led to the austerity of the 90s. That includes austerity under liberals. Liberals decided, well, we're not going to get out of this. We're going to get out of the social housing business. We're going to download this. We're going to download that. And then that in turn had Ontario sort of downloading things. And that's why you don't get any social housing for 30 years. You know, he sold off, you know, crown corporations because government's not in business. And then, you know, 30 years later, we're dealing with, you know, high gas prices and, you know, oil and gas companies making massive profits and not sharing the wealth with the consumer. So yeah, there's you know, there's a lot. And you know, last but not least, you know, Brian Mulroney was living in Palm Beach, Florida, not exactly what I'd call a mecca of the best and the brightest, because who was his neighbor in Palm Beach, Florida? If you said Donald Trump, you are correct. Now the presumptive nominee for president for the Republican Party, Donald Trump nearly has enough electoral college, not electoral college, but nearly enough delegates to officially claim that, although he is more or less now running unopposed. Nikki Haley announced on Tuesday night that she would be stepping down as a candidate for president after winning, actually, two primaries. She won the Washington, D.C. primary. She won the Vermont primary. So, obviously, that wasn't enough for her to launch a significant challenge against Donald Trump. But now it is officially Trump v. Biden, the rematch that nobody wanted, but we all managed to get just the same.
And Trump shouldn't take too lightly the amount of votes that went to Nikki Haley.
No,
I know he's saying that they're telling me it's the biggest ever. It's the biggest everything ever of ever.
It's not.
It's not, for one thing, as we know, because everything he says is just BS, pretty much. But that's indicative of what may be to come. Because a lot of the Haley votes in these primaries will go to Biden. Because there's nowhere else to go. And in fact, I think they've extended, like, you know, if you like Nikki Haley, you like us. I don't know if that says more about where Biden's at or where the Republicans are at or where anything is at. But yeah, there are indicators within these numbers that it's not the straight shot that he thinks it is. It has been, in terms of that he hasn't been campaigning, that he hasn't really done anything, and he doesn't really have anything to add or say except talking about himself. Like, at least when Nikki Haley gave her a speech there, regardless of how you feel about her, she was talking about issues, right? The debt, the size of the government, the dysfunctionality of the government, world conflicts. She was talking about actual issues. Trump talks about nothing.
And you know what Trump does today? He challenges Joe Biden to a debate. The audacity to, like, as soon as you, and it's you and Biden, and you challenge him to a debate after you have skipped every debate in your own primary. The audacity.
Yeah, that's very... Yeah, and that's kind of reflective of what you see of, you know, the anti-vax crowd who always want to debate me like that. Yeah. That's the same. Yeah. That has the same root. That has the same origin. It's like,
yeah,
I'm just going to spout off all this stuff. But no, we should debate. I mean, they're going to debate. I don't think it's going to be the rematch of the century. Like, because Trump will be like, well, you know, I won in 2020. Like, that's where he's coming from. Right. He still feels he should be the president anyway. So. It's going to be nuts. It's going to be really interesting, but interesting in a kind of we are sad for America way. Because, like, Biden's not looking so hot either. And I'm not just saying physically. We did talk about this before, but there's a clip making the rounds of Biden. He locked up again. He's like, I better not take any questions, and puts the mic down. And he just looks really lost, right? So it's not like... And of course, the Republicans are going to pounce on that. And it's not like Trump is sounding any better either. Trump sounds like absolutely out to lunch.
That speech of, like, Virginia on Saturday, where he, like, trails off and he's, like, making robot noises. And, you know, and he's talking about Obama and he's got to beat Obama. And it's like, you know, what year? Yeah. Like, I mean, the thing with Biden is, I acknowledge, you know, there are times he doesn't look good. But then you also have, like, Kevin McCarthy, who said, like, oh, yeah, like, in, like, negotiations, like, he was sharp as a tack. It's like, why would Kevin McCarthy say that? Because isn't it in his political best interest to, like, I was in a meeting with Joe Biden, and boy, did he look tired, and he looked, you know, he was so confused. It's like, what, you know, granted, Kevin McCarthy is not, like, a Trump Republican. In anything other than, like, the most, you know, sniveling, non-confrontational way. But still, it just there does seem to be this disparity between what we see with Biden and what people tell us about what he's like behind closed doors. The other thing I will say too, and people are talking about like the schism in the Democratic Party. Well, I found these stats interesting. Because it was Super Tuesday for the Democrats, too, and Biden was on the ballot in different primary states. He did better in a lot of states than Barack Obama did in 2012. In 2024, Biden gets 90%. In 2012, Barack Obama got 84%. This is in Alabama. In Arkansas, 90% for Biden, 58% for Obama. In Massachusetts, 82% for Biden, 81% for Obama. In North Carolina, 88% for Biden, 79% for Obama. In Oklahoma, 73% for Biden, 57% for Obama. Tennessee, 93% for Biden, 89% for Obama. There's something going up the works here where, yes, there are questions about Biden, but Democrats don't seem to be asking them or don't seem to be worried by them, by and large. Like, yeah, you get some loud ones like Dean Phillips, who was running a counter campaign to Biden. He resigned or he froze his presidential campaign on Wednesday. But Democrats seem pretty comfortable with the choice. Just saying.
Well, there is a little bit of rebellion there, too, in the number of uncommitted votes.
Yeah.
And no preference. And some of that was intentional to send a message about, I think, specifically Gaza.
Yeah.
To say, do something about, you know, watch this number because these are the people that aren't totally on board with you. So, again, similar to Trump, it's like it's not a perfect sweep. And, of course, it'll be presented as that. It's like it's unanimous. Everybody loves Biden. He did do really well, as you said.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, it's like. Where is this going? Are they both bad choices? Are they both not the best choice? And I think I said this before. It's like you really have to hope, and there's no hope in hell with Trump that they're going to pick a good VP.
No, it's going to be
Biden might. Trump definitely won't, because I don't think. And you were talking about their general health. It's like is it age? Is it repeated COVID infections? I don't know what's going on there, but. Just considering the march of time, it's like they're both going to have to choose really well. But right now they're both like, you know, Trump is like, we don't have a country. Our country's terrible. Everything's broken. And Biden's the same. It's like Trump's going to destroy democracy. It's like.
It's so weird because, it really is a battle of like democracy versus not democracy.
Yeah.
And you know, Biden. I can understand why it's so tough. Like, on the one hand, yeah, I've seen Joe Biden on a bike in the last year. Donald Trump looks gross when he's just strutting around in his golf outfit.
Yeah.
And, you know, on the other hand, you know, there has been a long history of Democrats in their 80s dying at the worst possible time. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Ted Kennedy.
Yeah.
You know, Dianne Feinstein, it's been known to happen, unfortunately. Now, having said that, you know, Kamala Harris is the VP now. It does seem like she's staying on the ticket. It doesn't, you know, she certainly hasn't made any announcements about any sort of change. I think a lot of the discourse around her is kind of, you know, typical of what you hear about a powerful black woman or a powerful woman of color.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me what she's accomplished as vice president, but then again, tell me anything any vice president has accomplished. It's not a position that yields itself to glory. But you're right. Like, maybe on the other hand, like, who do you want as vice president, or who do you want to be as president if the president should happen to pass away while in office? Well, with Joe Biden, you get Kamala Harris. If it's Donald Trump, you get Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Oh,
you
get
Elise Stefanik. Do you get Byron Donalds? Do you get Vivek Ramaswamy? It's just a murderer's row of buffoons. And, you know, I know what my answer is. I'm probably going to lean towards the former Attorney General of California, former Senator, former DA of San Francisco, as opposed to the billionaire who made money off of selling or buying bad patents and bad drug patents and raising the prices, or the Harvard lawyer who pretends she's an idiot, or the CrossFit trainer who believes in QAnon. Just, you know, just some thoughts.
Well, Trump did have a meeting this weekend with Elon Musk, and now whether that was to,
which was about money,
trying to secure some money for the, what is it, $600 million now that he's in the hole? But yeah, you know, maybe the deal would be, you know, if you want to be my VP, you can, you know.
100,000 more each week. Yeah, it's, I mean, that's a ticket and a half, isn't it? Donald Trump. No, Elon Musk can't be VP because he was born in South Africa.
Ah, right.
That's true.
But we learned with that Supreme Court decision that Trump can actually be on the ballot everywhere. So,
that's true. That's another big part of that was kind of really disappointing, that it was a kind of unanimous decision. All the liberal justices, all three of them, went along with it. But I mean, I think that was probably a fait accompli. It's sort of more concerning than that the Supreme Court has decided that, oh no, actually, we want to have a discussion about whether or not he has immunity. Could have taken the case late last year and be done with it by now, but then they waited 2 months and then suddenly realized last week, actually, they do have something to say about it. Sorry. No, sorry, we do want to have our say. We're going to have our say in April. So, I mean, all John Roberts, Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, cares about is that... you know, when you open the history books and you get to the chapter on the Roberts Court, all he wants, he just doesn't want it to read the Roberts Court, the most controversial and corrupt court in American history. But I mean, it's probably too late for that. So why not just ride with it? Ride or die. Ride or die with the court's corruption.
Yeah, it's pretty much America, ride or die at this point.
I mean, it's, you know, it's the 21st century version of take it or leave it, I guess.
Oh, we're laughing now, but no, November might be a different story.
Yeah, the live show in November might have an open bar.
Mm.
Yeah, or we might skip the live show this year during the election night.
But it's become such a tradition, though. It's expected of us, I think, Adam. So something should happen.
I guess. Well, something's definitely
get all of our guests back from last time and see if they...
Oh, boy.
See if the tune has changed. I'm sure it hasn't.
There's some guests from the past I'm not sure I want to hear from, but we'll talk about that during the break. You are listening to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
Well, I hope that song got you moving. No one can say that we don't mix it up on this show. That band's called La Sécurité from Montreal. The album's called Stay Safe. And the song, the Dur Club mix or remix, is called Suspens, which means suspense.
Lots of suspense, that's for sure.
That's our specialty.
Oh, yeah.
Keep them hanging. Keep them guessing.
Keeping them hanging, keeping them guessing. That might as well have been the liberals' plan for trying to get this national pharmacare strategy out. Yeah, it finally happened. For people who may not be aware, part of the confidence in supply agreement, wherein the NDP hold up the liberal government, hopefully till fall 2025, depending on who you ask, depended on the introduction of this national pharmacare strategy. Basically, we wanted to get to the point where there's essentially a universal healthcare plan for prescriptions. The framework was released last week. Essentially, they're starting with two areas. One is contraception, and you know, we'll probably touch on that a bit more as we get into the next topic. And the other is diabetes medication, because that is there are a lot of people in this country with diabetes, and I know firsthand, since my mom was a diabetic, those ain't cheap. That's not a cheap drugs. That's not a cheap disease to manage.
No.
So this is where the government is starting from. They are going to be developing a list of other drugs that they will be adding over time. But I think Chris Shelley pointed this out in the National Post. I'm loath to credit anything to the National Post, but sometimes they do get one right. We don't really have a national pharmacare strategy yet. What we have is a framework. You cannot go to Shoppers Drug Mart tomorrow and get your diabetes meds or your contraception meds for free. This is the beginning of the journey, and we're not still 100% sure where the end is going to be.
Yeah, I'd love to be more optimistic, but this reminds me of that song that's playing that's 600 years long or whatever, and a note changes every 36 years or whatever the heck it is, right?
And that song is called 99 Bottles of Beer on the Wall. No.
I don't know what it's called, but I think people know what I'm talking about. It's just that it's the timeline of this. Like, there's something here, but it just seems so weak. It's like all these discussions, and these are the two that you come up with. It kind of speaks to topic one. We're saying there, like, do you there's certain things you're not doing because you're going to piss enough people off.
Yeah.
Now, mind you, I mean, diabetes medication, and my father was on it as well. So I mean, I know you're coming from there when you say that. It's one of the, I think there's more than one of them is in the top 10 list of medications in Canada. So in terms of just sheer prescriptions, diabetes, one and two is way up there. And I think there's some, they're trying to put some kind of deal in here as well for insulin pumps, which all of that is good. Yep. All of this is a good thing. But as you say, what's the framework? How is this going to play out? Right away, Alberta out of the gate is like, we're opting out. We just give us the money. We don't want any part of this.
That was the beauty part of it. It's like, we don't want the plan. Just give us the money. That might as well be put on Alberta license plates.
But if you're of the conservative mindset and everything is about finding efficiencies, a national pharmacare plan tied to Medicare would find efficiencies across the board, right? Because you eliminate all the tiers. You eliminate Alberta wanting one thing. You would eliminate Quebec wanting another thing. But because, and I'm going to use the phrase corporate again, should I throw robber barons in for good measure?
Absolutely.
There's just so much influence there from drug companies, let's call it Big Pharma, that stand to lose, or at least they feel they're going to lose in these types of deals, because, you know, a certain amount of control is removed from their hands. Control from insurance is removed from insurance's hands. So the pie isn't as large and isn't as divvied up when you've got a block buying drugs for a whole nation. And as we know, Canada is the only G7 nation that has universal healthcare that doesn't have prescription drugs tied to it. I don't know the history of that. They really screwed up. Now, mind you, back when we got universal healthcare, however many years ago now, at least 50 and longer for certain provinces like Saskatchewan, there weren't as many drugs. You didn't have diabetes medication. You didn't have these things. You weren't on as many pills. Now, that's not to say that that was a better life, but it just didn't exist. So we're now we're trying to tack something on to something that was structurally devised many years ago. And I'm saying they're separate but together, right? They're never going to blend the two of them together. This is a missed opportunity of not doing it out of the gate. Things would have probably been a lot different. But yeah, I did see a headline. I didn't read the article. Was that if this didn't happen, the NDP were going to pull support. That would have been it. We would have been an election. Wouldn't have had anything.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether that's just a threat or who knows. But I mean, I've got a feeling, as we also talked about in topic one, Polyev will somehow manage to pull the plug on this should, if, and when he becomes prime minister. It'll just die.
Oh, yeah. No, everything. Disappear. I mean, everything will go away. Like $10 a day, childcare is going to go away. I mean, and it's not going to be like an announcement. They're just not going to fund it anymore.
Yeah. I mean, anything with a whiff of socialism, they don't like.
Yeah.
Or social democracy, let's call it, right? As you said, for Alberta there, like, no, we just don't want that. it comes from liberals and New Democrats. We don't want it. That's what she's really saying. That's what Danielle Smith is really saying. It's nothing to do with helping people or what's best for Canada and Canadians with diabetes and, you know, and then birth control, another matter. But
no, all of that is correct. I think, and that's why it's kind of disappointing that this is such weak sauce. But I mean, it also speaks to both the desperation of the Liberals and the NDP. I mean, you know, Jagmeet Singh can, you know, shake his fist and make threats all he wants, but he knows he's not gonna, you know, he knows this is that for NDP objectives, the time is now.
Yeah,
because he's not going to get anything, especially if like there's a supermajority of conservatives. Forget about it.
He said something that I thought was really weird. He said Singh said the election of more NDP MPs is what's required to get more classes of drugs added.
Yeah,
like really, that's what's required? I thought what was required was to come up with a universal healthcare or pharmacare program. Like that. It sort of makes sense to me, but at the same time, you're tying the coming election to this, right? So that's what it's going to, like, we need to elect you, so we'll get more drugs. It's like, why don't you just do the more drugs thing now? But like I said, it's going to take 683 years at this rate before all drugs are included, right?
Well, that's the confusing thing about where the NDP is at right now, is that, you know, they obviously want to win more seats. They obviously want to form a government themselves, but they're just not going to. It's kind of outside the realm of possibility. But at the same time, you know, they got to pretend like they're playing to win, or, you know, actually genuinely think they have a chance of winning. But I mean, having said that, yeah, this is something that is needed. And you're right. Just, you know, the life has changed so much in the last 80, 90, 100 years. You know, it's impossible to go through life without a prescription. And I wrote this down for the next. Did I write it down for the next topic, or is this something I saw in passing? Anyway,
I'm not sure.
No, $1.5 billion a year. Like, that's how much we spend on medications. This is a pretty big chunk of the Canadian economy, and it's not, you know, it's not extra. You know, when you go and see the doctor and the doctor recommends a course of action and involves a prescription, that's not a nice to have. That's part of your treatment.
Mm-hmm.
Why isn't this sort of like covered in the OHIP of it, or whatever your provincial plan is? And I think this is something that I think a lot of us are becoming more and more key to. You know, our medical insurance doesn't cover everything. Yeah, if you go to the hospital and your arm is falling off, they'll sew it back on for you and you'll be fine and you're not given a bill. However, when you're staying in the hospital, you can accrue costs.
Mm-hmm.
When you're, you know, when you leave the hospital and you're given a prescription, you accrue a cost. If you need rehab, that can accrue a cost. To get tests and things after, like if you go to Life Labs to get blood work and it's a test that's outside of, you know, certain parameters, that comes with a cost. And we see this, some provinces are responding with, well, we got to increase funding. Other provinces are responding, well, we need to get more private sector in there. And in so much as this national pharmacare program, it's like, we need it, it's necessary, it's a nice to have, move it a little slow. There is a national healthcare crisis. And I mean, a lot of people have made the point that Ontario hasn't said anything, whether or not they'll sign on or not. To me, Doug Ford is not someone who gives, you know, doesn't look too deep at the gift horse in the mouth, or however you want to explain that. So I'm sure he would go along with something if there's some sort of negotiation with the federal government. On the other hand, Doug Ford's also the guy who's, you know, letting nurse practitioners open private clinics, and, you know, you go in and tap your debit card, $200 later, you get treatment right away, as opposed to sitting in an emergency, an understaffed emergency room for 8 hours.
Doug Ford's decision will depend on which friends are going to benefit, if any.
Sure.
That's will be the basis in Ontario, right? Now, I keep hearing the argument too that, oh, well, most people have some kind of insurance. No, they don't.
No, they don't.
Not the people, not the people that I know.
Yeah.
Right. So sure. it's like, well, most people have some kind of insurance. No, they don't. And even if you do have insurance, like you were kind of saying there, it's things aren't necessarily covered.
Mm-hmm.
You know, take your pick. The prostate test, that hasn't been paid for in years now.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's provincial level, but that's one off the top of my head. It's like, you need that done. You think there's a problem. You just shell out for it. And they're chipping away and chipping away at all of that until it is just in the American style, which is, in my view, is the goal.
Mm-hmm.
Create the crisis. And getting back to Ontario, what are they sitting on? $5 billion or something now? The rainy day fund. And things are falling apart, particularly with healthcare. They won't inject any cash into it. But like you said, private clinics can open up. They find a loophole, whether it's blood plasma or whatever the hell it is now. We will find a loophole and drive right through it. And then that service is no longer, it'll be like, well, they're doing it now. So that whole BS about health card versus credit card, you know, hold on to your hats, because this decade in particular, I think, is going to be the change. We're already feeling it. We're already seeing it. But, you know, getting back to something like pharmacare, it's proven everywhere that happens that there is a savings, that efficiencies are found. If people are taking their medications and they're healthy and they're staying out of the system and they don't have to go to the ER or whatever for a renewal, then that all is a greater savings. But it doesn't make the robber barons any money. So...
Well, if there's one thing I think we can all agree is that we need more female robber barons. but seriously, folks, tomorrow, Friday, is International Women's Day. UN, the United Nations, has apparently they do different themes every year for International Women's Day. And this year's theme is Invest in Women, Accelerate Progress. And this is the idea that if we can accelerate and make investments in the economy, to eliminate barriers for women, we can achieve more and create a better world. There's some interesting statistics that go with this. I got from Statistics Canada. 17% of all medium and small businesses in Canada are run by women, only 17%. There's a $150 billion impact on the economy when it comes to inequality for women. The difference of 10 to 14% when it comes to men and women for unpaid work. So what you're talking about is like things like child care, things like house care, like, you know, the kind of domestic things. 14% of that unpaid work is done by women. 10% is done by men. You have 10% of women in Canada living on low incomes. 23% of women with disabilities live on low income. 28% of women-led households, so single moms, are low-income households. Women make $43,000 in annual income versus $60,600. Did I say 43 million? Because I meant 43,000. Anyway, 60,600 for men. And I found this one interesting. This has to do with the pink tax, which is something I thought of with this. Products for women cost 7% more on average than men. And that includes 15% more for shirts, 13% more for helmets and knee pads, and 50% more for soap and deodorant. And it's also funny, not funny, haha. But I found this website, Smart Money in Manitoba, and one of the ways it recommends women to avoid paying the pink tax is to just buy men's products because they're essentially the same, except they market the products to women and have that huge markup. So, I mean, there is a definite connection between economic prosperity and the pink tax and you know, lower wages for women than men. So I think there is there is something on to this. There's something to this theme that the UN has established for this year's International Women's Day.
Oh, many years ago, I had some roommates, women that had completely rebelled against the products even back then because it was so clear. Everything from razors to you name it, deodorant was just like
15% more for a shirt.
Yeah, it's just stupid, but keeps on going, right? Like there's no. That's branding and it's corporate and all those things. Rather, but you know, when the discussion becomes about products and stuff from the UN rather than smashing the patriarchy. I mean, if you want to get back to the roots,
back to basics, yeah,
back to basics of International Women's Day. I mean, no one likes this, but it is actually a socialist day of observation.
Mm.
It's a holiday in Russia. It's a holiday in a holdover from Soviet times in Cuba. You name it. That's the roots of this, but it's been flipped. I mean, I noticed right away when you Google International Women's Day these days, Reitman's is changing its name to Right Woman's for International Women's Day tomorrow. So, and this is a known company that leans on sweatshop labor, the backs of women the world over to make the products to sell here and in other places. So until I think it becomes about those questions, and I know people don't necessarily like to talk about the heavier stuff, right?
Yeah.
Whether it's just general oppression, gender justice, violence, intimate partner violence, discrimination, misogyny, you know, that is all still out there. Or, you know, if you're just a woman in Gaza these days, starved or killed just for existing, and your children, you know, it's like, it's heavy and it's a lot, but it doesn't seem to register. It registers in certain places. You have somebody like me who registers with to tell you this and to just, you know, throw a dark cloud over everything as I tend to do. But it is, you know, it's right across the board.
Right. I think one of the things that gets at, though, is like how hard is it to take care of, like, which is the easy stuff, which is like things like the pink tax.
Yeah.
You know, things like, you know, why is a woman paying 50% more for this almost the exact same stick of deodorant or the same bottle of body wash or whatever? I think this plays into a lot of things, and it's not to like undermine sort of the more serious stuff you're talking about, but you know, and this kind of gets back into topic one when feels like nobody wants to gamble, nobody has like an investment to solve things anymore. We can't solve this easy stuff. We can't, like, what was it? Marketplace last year did the thing on the pink tax.
Yep.
And like only Shoppers Drug Mart was like, yeah, I guess we feel kind of sorry about it, so we're going to make some changes. And it was only Shoppers Drug Mart. It's like one chain out of a whole, one part of one chain out of a whole bunch of other chains. Mm-hmm. It just, you know, we can't really do the simple stuff, which makes doing the harder stuff, which is like actually developing like things like national universal childcare. You know, childcare still costs $10 a day. You know, how much capital and GDP and whatever would be unlocked if, you know, women had like some assurity with their childcare options. And that was another thing this week, thinking locally, is that, you know, the $10 a day childcare is enormously popular in our region, Guelph and Wellington County.
Yep.
We just don't have the spaces for it. The wait list is a mile long, and kind of all they can do is sort of like better manage the wait list. You know, there's really kind of no funds to help make spaces available. There aren't, you know, we're not paying ECEs a living wage, many of whom are women, in order to make working in childcare attractive. And you know, we kind of also kind of still depend on women to do certain jobs along those fields. Like how massive it is the number of women in education fields, childcare fields. You know, it's pretty incredible. You know, it's not like there aren't opportunities there, but on the other hand, too, we don't give them a give them a living wage either. We don't really value the work like we should. So, I mean, 100% agree with your dark cloud, but I mean,
yeah, sorry to put a downer on them.
We can't really shoo away the light clouds either.
No, that's true. And kind of speaking to that a bit too, I mean, a lot of it is on men, but just talking about work and free time, where was the study out of Pew Research saying that just the world over that men seem to have 5 hours more free time than women in general? So that's gender gap stuff writ large, right? Because it usually involves children.
Yeah.
That time involves children almost all the time, as you say, with childcare and lack of childcare. But I mean, even with childcare, who is doing the picking up, who is doing the caring for the kids when they're ill and all of that stuff, and buying the Pampers, whether they're gendered or whatever. And oh yeah, I wonder if the products thing spreads to that too, whether it's like the pink ones are always 10% more, but yeah, so it's like just so much to contend with, and how does that get sorted out? And going back to the farmer care, sort of, because a lot of the provinces, it took a hell of a long time for the provinces to sort out, you know, which ones are going to get that $10 a day childcare deal, and then the childcare, the companies or corporations are saying, no, we're not making any money at this if you do this.
Yeah.
So it always comes back to that, right? It always comes back to business and money. And can we say robber barons for all four topics?
Well, you just did. You just did.
Get rid of them and things will get better for all of us, not just women.
No, for sure. And I mean, we're two men talking about this.
Oh, and there's that too, by the way. We should have put a disclaimer at the beginning.
I do. Like, yeah, I want to kind of
do this every time.
Yeah, I wanted to work that disclaimer in too. But I mean, you're right. Like, about sort of the optics of that, I think there's also issues with worth talking about around men, and this kind of how it factors into women. There are so many sort of disparate and lonely men that they are being sort of hoovered up by all these less than desirable role models, the Jordan Petersons of the world, the Andrew Tates of the world. I mean, that's a factor of equity too, is that there are a lot of sort of, I hate to say, disenfranchised men, or men who at least feel disenfranchised, because while we're sitting here talking about, you know, the need for equity for women, they're not feeling the equity themselves, whether that's with, you know, good paying jobs, opportunities, access to capital, access to that free time. What are they doing with that free time? We have enormous issues that are sort of tied to gender, and a lot, I guess that's one of the reasons why I found this interesting, sort of tying women's issues this year to sort of economic matters, because I think there are also broader societal issues that, you know, men have to deal with in terms of how they regard the increased equity, because there are a lot of men who aren't handling it well and are kind of pushing them into further, like, dark, disturbing realms of misogyny, and that gets into your areas of intimate partner violence and things. But absolutely, I think there needs to be a sort of bigger discussions about where men fit into this as well, which is why I think it's valuable that we are having the discussion, trying to say, like, we are aware that there are issues facing women, from the minor to the massive, because men do play a role in that too.
Well, you know, I'm just going to blame capitalism for everything, right? Like, that's...
I had a feeling.
Have you got an hour? Have you got 3 hours?
That should be a Patreon tier, that we should have somebody, like, if you give so much to Open Source as well, Scotty will come to your house and for an hour and talk about...
Give you a tirade?
Talk about capitalism and how it's bad for everybody. I'm afraid that's the only way you're going to get an extra hour out of this show, because we're at the end of our time. Unless you have a last word.
No, I was just going to say happy International Women's Day to all of those who observe it.
Yeah, and there's opportunities here in town to observe it. There are events. There's going to be a gathering in front of City Hall around the noon hour on Friday, so check that out. And there's an event at the Sheldale Family Gateway. I think that's between 11 and 3. but all very kind of easy to consult online through the various Facebook groups and Guelph. Also, the Guelph Politico newsletter, I had some dates and times and locations in there too. But yeah, that's it for this week's show, I'm afraid. We hope you liked it. If you want to listen to us again, you can download it every Monday from our website, opensourcesguelph.com. You can get it from the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean or through your favorite app like Apple, Google, TuneIn, and Spotify. You can stay connected to us on social media. We're on Facebook at Open Sources Newswire, and we're on Twitter at OS_Guelph. I shall return on Wednesday at 3 p.m. for the movie review show that I co-host called End Credits. And you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or go to my news and politics site at guelphpolitico.ca.
And I'm Scotty Hertz on Facebook, Twitter. Oh my God, I almost said Google Maps. Look for the bunker in the ward. Facebook, Twitter, and Blue Sky. And if you're joining us at a regular time at 5 p.m. on a Thursday, please stay tuned for the volunteer playlist.
And that's one of the many great programs that you'll hear on CFRU 93.3 FM, this station, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. As for this very show, we will return next Thursday at 5 p.m. for another edition of Open Sources Guelph, and we will see you next week.